Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we are joined by Professor Eric Jennings of the University of Toronto, who will be discussing his new book, Escape from Vichy, The Refugee Exodus to the French Caribbean. Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Robin, for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. Before we delve into the book itself, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Certainly. So I'm a professor at the University of Toronto, where I've been since 1998. I am a fellow at Victoria College. My background is that I did my undergraduate work at Toronto, and then I went to Berkeley for my PhD. And I suppose I should mention that I'm a French colonial historian, first and foremost, with a strong interest in World War II France as well. So I wear several hats. Last but not least, I'm a citizen of Canada and France.
Oh, interesting. And you were at Victoria College, you mentioned.
Exactly. So Victoria College is actually a university within the University of Toronto, but I have this multiple identity within the University of Toronto as a fellow of Victoria College and a full-time member of the Department of History.
Okay, wonderful. I myself was at Trinity College, so there will be a bit of a rivalry throughout this podcast,
but just a stone's throw away. Yeah.
Just a stone's throw away. So with that said, what brought you to write Escape from Vichy?
Well, there's actually a whole background to this story, as there often is. I think this must have started with my PhD dissertation, because my PhD thesis dealt with the Vichy regime overseas. It subsequently came out as a book titled Vichy in the Tropics. And as I researched the fate of the French Caribbean during World War II, the fact that these islands remained under the orbit of Vichy for three long years, I realized, looking at correspondence, that there were a great many refugees coming in on board cargo ships. And I thought this was quite odd and had not really been written about, except for some witnesses, I certainly, and people who'd been on board these ships. So then I turned to the writings of people like Claude Lévi-Strauss and realized, wow, there seems to have been an actual migration wave and not just a few isolated travelers. So this had showed up in Vichy-era reports of local governors in 1941, 1940, complaining about incoming refugees and how they were placing a strain on resources.
Okay, interesting. So what then were your research questions sort of from the beginning, and how did you go about answering?
Well, that project was then on the back burner for a while. One of the interesting things about this project is that it took me in so many different directions. There's so many threads to pull at. One of the first instincts that I had turned out to have been a good one was to write Claude Lévi-Strauss while he was still alive and ask him how on earth he found out about these boats and how he got on board. And he very graciously answered me. So that was sort of stage one. But then when I returned to this project in the 21st century, I began asking myself deep questions about what kind of migration this was. And at the basis of it all is this question that I don't think I ultimately resolve. I think I sort of let the reader decide for themselves about whether this was, in a sense, rescue or whether it was expulsion. So that's one set of questions. Another set of questions has to do about the nature of the Vichy regime. You know, the Vichy regime dealt with, grappled with the refugee crisis in France in a variety of ways, and it certainly took place in stages. So my question there was, you know, does this fit in with a particular stage of Vichy policy towards refugees? And then, of course, I became interested in questions of migration and how difficult it was to emigrate and who got to emigrate when. Was it sheer luck to get on a boat? So all of these different problematics started emerging in tandem. I realized very quickly that this was more than an article and that I needed to do a book with this.
Okay. And you mentioned that there are, you know, there were so many different directions that you were being pulled in. And also, you know, throughout the book, you bring in such a variety of disciplinary approaches and you look at such a wealth of material. How did you go about, you know, finding the material that you ultimately analyze?
Well, there too, it was quite a web. As I suggested, I certainly spent a lot of time in the French colonial archives, which are located in Aix-en-Provence, which provided me with a lot of information about how this route opened up in the first place, the reaction of local officials, but also through things like censorship files, I was able to actually retrieve some of the contemporaneous voices of migrants themselves, which was really quite wonderful. So that was one huge cache of materials. But with a topic like this, I also had to go to the French Caribbean, where there was materials on the makeshift camps in which these refugees were placed. A great deal of correspondence on everything from, you know, the conditions of these refugees to feeding them to the encounters that they made. But then also I was extremely interested in the reasons why this route came undone in May 1941. So that then brought in a whole international layer to the question. It took me to Washington. It took me to London. It took me to the Netherlands. And beyond that, of course, I was interested in hearing what the refugees had to say about their trips, how they themselves experienced this from, in some instances, local camps in southern France, like Gurs and Rivesaltes and Les Milles, to their voyage on board the ship, to their experience in Martinique, and then on to other places like Mexico. And to do that, I had to delve into the archives of the refugees, which I found in places like Albany, New York, and Frankfurt, Germany. So there were many, many different venues for research here. And I have to say that without the support of the Guggenheim Foundation and the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, I could never have gone to all of these different locations myself. It really was an extraordinarily time-consuming endeavor.
Yeah, it sounds like you really traveled the globe. I mean, to some pretty amazing destinations, but quite a bit of work. I wonder if we should take a step back and if you could give our listeners a bit of background information on this topic. So what was the political situation in France at this time? And why were there so many refugees in the country?
So my story really picks up in the late 1930s. And as you know, people like Vicky Caron have written extensively on the refugee crisis in France. And so I really pick up the story with this influx of refugees coming to France. Obviously, in the 1930s, France remained a bastion of democracy on the face of it. Italy had fallen to Mussolini in the 20s. Hitler, of course, took over in Germany in 1933. By the late 30s, Franco had emerged victorious in Spain. So this is the story of thousands upon thousands of political, but also economic refugees finding their way to France, right? We have to add to the list that I just drew up, Armenians coming to France, Russians coming to France. So in addition to the German and Austrian Jews who were fleeing persecution in Germany, to the Spanish Republicans who were fleeing Franco, and to Italian socialists fleeing Mussolini, you have to add all those other waves of migration. And then you have to superimpose that onto the French context, where we know from economic historians, the Great Depression took its toll relatively late compared to, say, Germany or the US. So you have a bit of a perfect storm in late 1930s France in that sense. And of course, you also have the ambient anti-Semitism, the rise of the crypto-fascist or outright fascist leagues, the paramilitary organizations, all of these gaining momentum in 1930s France as well. So that's the backdrop. But the questions that historians have posed around this, I think, remain in some ways burning questions, which is to say, to what extent does Vichy mark a rupture or a continuity with respect to the 30s and the treatment of refugees in the 1930s? That's one of the big ones. And without giving it away, my book obviously looks at both sides of that story, but it's obvious that the answer is it's a little bit of both. Certainly the people who were at the helm at Vichy didn't emerge out of thin air. And certainly some of the ideologies, thinking, for instance, of the very motto, work, family, fatherland, those were some of the mottos of the leagues in the 30s. But at the same time, even though, you know, these refugees had been piled into makeshift camps throughout the 30s, one has to recognize that there were no explicitly anti-Semitic texts passed by the French Third Republic either. So context matters. And what starts to happen after the fall of France, when France is defeated in a record 6 weeks by Nazi Germany in May-June 1940, is that these refugees that had been in very precarious and difficult circumstances suddenly find themselves literally at risk. In a quite new context, they go from being seen as, sure, scapegoats of the far right to not just scapegoats, but identified by Vichy and other extremists as the very reason for France's defeat, somehow the rot within France that would have supposedly sapped France from within. And also very pragmatically, the armistice conditions of 1940 were such that Vichy, in theory, had to hand over on demand German or Austrian nationals wanted by the Nazis. So even though these refugees found themselves in the so-called unoccupied zone in southern France, there was still already a measure of risk. And I'm very careful to tether all of this to a chronology and a context. I don't want to read history backwards. I don't want to fast forward to the Holocaust. Nevertheless, they were acutely aware of some of the risks that they faced already in 1940 and 41.
Okay. And I mean, there's of course so much literature written on Vichy, and as you mentioned, even on the refugee crisis within France at this time. Why do you think that this history hasn't really been told yet?
I'm not sure I have an obvious answer to that very good question. The story has been told at its fringes, right? Or it's been told in ways that center it differently. I center the story on Martinique as a kind of hub. To make a long story short, Martinique was chosen for these departures in part because it was a French overseas territory and therefore could be reached by people who already had a visa to be in mainland France. The ways in which it's been told by people interested in some of the protagonists in this story, like Victor Serge or Claude Lévi-Strauss or André Breton, is to look at the ultimate point of destination, to sort of fast forward over the Martinique stopover and look towards New York or look towards Mexico. And that's been problematic because it elides all of the complexities of this voyage and the reasons for it.
Right. And you, yeah. Sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say you alluded to how Martinique was perhaps for people who had French visas, you know, a more realistic option. But what other sorts of options for emigration did migrants have? What obstacles did they encounter if they were, you know, on the quest to emigrate?
So the short answer is that there were constantly shifting hierarchies of options, and that these options remained in southern France, at least until August 1942, things that would shift balance but remain possible. It was still possible to get out of unoccupied Vichy southern France until late 1942. Some of those other alternate escape avenues included Portugal, the Lisbon avenue of escape. Going over the Alps into Switzerland remained obviously a viable option. Going over the Pyrenees into Spain and then on to a variety of other locations. And of course, there's also the Casablanca layover, which was part of the Martinique route that I described. So all of these were places where people got to. There are other destinations as well. Palestine remained an option, although as the war spreads to the Middle East, there was anxiety around Palestine as well. And last but not least, some of the more surprising destinations in East Asia. So some people got on board boats destined to French Indochina, and from there found their way to Shanghai. So there were a number of different places to potentially go. The question was, what opportunities were made available at what time, and how did people access them? And that's something that I've tried to recover. In particular, I show, for instance, the correspondence between Eric Etor Khan and his wife, Frida, who constantly go back and forth. He's being interned at the camp in Les Milles. She is in a hotel in Marseille, and they write each other about all of these different options. One day it seems like they'll be heading to the US Caribbean. Next thing you know, they are thinking of Lisbon. Then they're thinking of Morocco, and Martinique becomes an option late in the game, and it's one that they decide to seize. So this is negotiated and it's context specific.
And you also write that, I mean, you have all of these fascinating individuals that come into your story as major characters, but you write that to many of them, the opening of the Martinique corridor sort of seemed like, you know, fortuitous happenstance at the time, or, you know, something like that. But of course, it's more complex than that. Could you explain, you know, how it came about?
Sure. So your first point is really important. A lot of the refugees thought it was providential. Even Varian Fry of the Emergency Rescue Committee, whose self-appointed mission is to rescue European celebrities in danger at this point, basically says, well, this was better than anything I could have dreamt up on my own. It was wonderful. It bypassed all of the difficulties before. And some of the refugees themselves actually imagined that Varian Fry in person had persuaded the Vichy government to make these freighters available. It turns out that Varian Fry's organization certainly capitalized on this line, but they are not the ones who opened it. And one of the big archival finds that I made early on had to do with this document in the French colonial archives from late November 1940, emanating from Vichy's interior minister, Marcel Perrouton. And what Perrouton is doing is he is opening this corridor to the Caribbean, to the French Caribbean, for refugees in France whom he deems, and this is really important, he deems them overrepresented. He more or less alludes that they're parasites, unwanted in France. But he also, in the same breath, talks about not failing on the rules of humanity and having to find a place for these people to go. So it's this really interesting, dichotomous set of instructions that seems to at once mandate expulsion and rescue in, as I said, in the same breath. And thereafter, indeed, that Martinique corridor opens up. And I've been able, one of the things that I got to in the end were the records of freighter companies and shipping companies. That took a great deal of time. But I was able to reconstitute the number of departures, the freighters, where they stopped, how many people they had on board in a great many cases. And I've come up with this figure of roughly 5,000 refugees who got out in this way between the moment that this instruction goes out in late November 1940 and the time that the route unravels in May of 1941. So it's a quite significant corridor of escape or expulsion. Walter Mehring, one of the German Jewish poets on board, points out that, yes, he was being expelled, but it was wonderful to be expelled. And he really crisply encapsulates the contradiction at the heart of this Martinique corridor.
And 5,000 people in that period of time, I mean, that's a significant undertaking. You know, how did people go about acquiring a spot on one of these ships?
Oh, it's a great question. And unfortunately, there's no single scenario, even though I have all of these wonderful testimonies.
Right. Perhaps a couple different examples.
Yeah. So, you know, Anna Segers, the famous German communist novelist, talks at great length about her experiences waiting in visa lines, waiting for, it's not just the visa that's required, it's then permission to get into a country in the Western Hemisphere. The United States at this point is significantly closing its doors, but so too gradually are Mexico and Cuba and other options. So it's waiting in line for countless hours for visa, for exit visas, for shipping documents, for various papers like this, making sure one has the requisite funds. It was very expensive to get on the boat. A down payment was needed to assure the Martinique authorities that that these refugees would not become a burden. So there were all of these hurdles, both financial and administrative. And of course, some of these refugees spoke pretty shaky French. They were in constant showdowns with the administration. And some of them write of this being an almost Sisyphean task of having made inroads one day only to see it all coming undone the next. And Anna Segers really wonderfully describes all of this in a semi-fictional novel, Transit, in which she talks about the hopes, disillusions, and dashed expectations of so many of these refugees. What's interesting to me is some of them are very complicit with each other. They help each other out. Others elbow each other out of lineups. There's the whole gamut of human behavior on display in this extremely anxious setting of Marseille, where these thousands upon thousands of refugees are trying to line up in front of the U.S. consulate, lining up in front of the shipping companies, and then lining up as well before the gendarmes as they set sail. So there's these countless hurdles. And the people who finally get on board, almost all of them, when they talk about this, and I'm lucky enough to have correspondence even from people on the ships, talk about just letting out a huge sigh of relief once they board these vessels. Even though the vessels, these are hardly cruise liners, they're pretty dingy cargoes, but everybody is greatly relieved to be leaving.
And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the mechanics of the actual journey. So, of course, it wasn't all done in you know, one quick sail. Where did people go through and what were the stops?
So, well, first of all, the first challenge, as I said, was on the very docks of Marseille, where you had to get past police lines, you had to get past customs, you had to have all of your papers in order. I was surprised at how many people I found, Italians, Germans, you name it, who managed to get out without all the papers being fully checked off. And Varian Fry and Walter Mehring both recount, for instance, the exit of Mehring, who is told by somebody right on the docks, you don't have the required paperwork. Worse still, your name appears on a list. Then a phone call is made, and next thing you know, the police official says, perhaps you're another Walter Mehring. Off you go. So there's definitely acts of complicity involved in this story as well, where refugees benefit from complicit functionaries. And one of the questions I ask is whether these are Perrouton's instructions being followed through, or whether, in fact, these are officials that are defying the rules. I think there's a little bit of both. And I was able to retrieve one low-ranking functionary in Marseille who clearly assisted a great many officials. So that's been some of the interesting discoveries on that end. But then, yes, the refugees then board these many vessels. These vessels, first of all, were absolutely essential to the Vichy regime as well. They served many purposes. One of them is that they constituted an umbilical cord for the islands of Martinique and Guadeloupe, which were these little confettis of Vichy in the Western Hemisphere. And it was important from the standpoint of the authorities there that the products from Martinique and Guadeloupe, the bananas, the rum, the sugar, that there be an outlet for them. And these same cargoes that arrived in Martinique with refugees would depart with their hulls full of bananas and rum and sugar. So that sort of explains the existence of the route. Interestingly, I found that there were complex negotiations that Vichy was engaged in with the Americans to keep the route going, with the British to a lesser extent indirectly, who wanted to shut it down, but also with the Germans. Vichy wanted to make sure that these cargoes weren't sunk because they obviously wanted this material to keep going back and forth. So it was a very tenuous sort of route, one that you know, sort of hung by a thread. It's the first stop from Marseille was typically somewhere in Algeria, so Oran or Algiers. And then the second stop would have been in Morocco. And some refugees actually boarded the ships to Martinique from Morocco, where some of them had been interned in makeshift camps for a year or a few months. So there's that aspect as well. So this connects to the sort of Hollywood vision of the film Casablanca as well, to some extent. And then from there, they would go on the high seas uninterruptedly as far as Martinique, averting the many perils, obviously, of U-boats at sea and all of that.
Right. And you also describe the passengers themselves as a sort of motley crew. So who were some of these refugees who found themselves on these ships, and what were their experiences along the journey?
So there were, in a sense, it's the mirror image of the refugee crisis that I talked about. There were a great many foreign refugees stranded in France. There were also French nationals wanting to get out, some of them Jewish, and knowing that they were in some degree of trouble. This was the case for André Breton and for Claude Lévi-Strauss, for instance, both French nationals, one of them Jewish, the other not, but both potentially seen as enemies of the regime for quite different reasons. And then amongst the foreign nationals, you have some leading figures of the Spanish Popular Front. You have leading Italian anti-fascists like Marcello Montagnana, who found his way to the French Caribbean this way, and a great many German communists, German Jews. I mentioned Anna Segers, but certainly there's a whole group of them on board these ships. One of the interesting things is the connections that these people make on board. So, for instance, Mina Flacke had been a doctor in Germany. She'd been involved in children's medicine in Berlin. She made a number of interesting connections, first of all in the camps in southern France, and then on the boats themselves. And these refugees talk about one another. So she gets mentioned, for instance, by Germaine Krull, who is another foreign refugee on board. Krull is an avant-garde photographer of Polish and Dutch extraction. She is actually on board to try to join De Gaulle's Free French, which she ultimately does by way first of Martinique, then Brazil, and then she gets assigned by De Gaulle. She gets posted in Central Africa. So these refugees enter into dialogue with one another. There's a great many intellectuals. I'm thinking, for instance, of somebody like Jacques Chiffrin, who was the founder of the Pléiade literary series in France and was making his way to New York by way of Martinique. So it was quite an incredible assembly of European thinkers as well who were leaving for the Caribbean.
And what were their experiences of arrival? You know, how were they received by locals and by officials, perhaps by other refugees?
So once in location on the Caribbean, a deal was reached. So the governors of Martinique and Guadeloupe, as well as the admiral at the helm in the French Caribbean, Admiral Robert, wanted really as few refugees as possible. And it's mainland Vichy that imposed these continued arrivals on them, and they fought them tooth and nail. Mm. So the officials on location were extremely harsh to these refugees.
Is that mostly because of limited resources? Or?
Well, that's part of it, but there's ideology as well. So both Germaine Krull and Claude Lévi-Strauss recount arriving and then being grilled by people who aren't customs agents at all, they're police people. And they proceed to harass them, saying, you know, you people are not true French people, blaming them for the fall of France, hurling insults at them. André Breton is told in no uncertain terms that he's not to befriend any Martinicans and certainly not to share his subversive ideas with them. So the treatment is rather brusque and harsh. Several of the travelers who were actually German Jews who'd left for France come up with the same idea, which is this isn't a really French treatment. These must be Germans in disguise. So harsh was the greeting party, so to speak. However, once they pass this rather unpleasant curtain, there's no doubt that the two camps in which foreigners are placed, one in Balata and the other called Le Lazaret, that these two camps are considerably less harsh than the conditions that the European that they're leaving in Europe. Just to give one example, regularly refugees miss roll call in the evening and nothing happens to them. And certainly the French nationals don't end up in these makeshift camps at all. They are allowed to find a hotel in town in Fort-de-France. So the answer is, at once, they're treated quite harshly as possible subversives. In some instances, they're spied upon by the local police. In many instances, they're insulted. But at the end of the day, they benefit from, on average, more lenient living conditions than they had in southern mainland France.
And you also highlight that, you've already mentioned that there were some fascinating intellectuals among this group. You highlight some interesting interactions between these intellectuals and local Martinician thinkers as well. Could you tell us more about some of these encounters?
So there is, that's I think one of the intriguing facets of this, is that there's this incredible synergy between, on the one hand, some of the surrealists who are arriving, in particular André Breton, but also somebody like Wilfredo Lam, who's a great Cuban painter who has spent considerable time in Europe, including in Spain, fighting with on the Republican side, and now is finding his way back to the Caribbean. There's considerable synergy between these travelers on the one hand, and on the other hand, Martinican intellectuals, in particular the group around Aimé and Suzanne Césaire, who at this very time are articulating new ideas of negritude, or re-articulating negritude, in a quite wonderful newspaper called Tropique. And the chance encounter between the surrealists on the one hand, these travelers, and on the other hand, the apostles of negritude, really takes a place. It takes place around Tropique. André Breton stumbles upon an issue of it, asks to see the people who produced this wonderful review, and the story goes on from there with considerable cross-fertilization. So surrealism definitely is injected with new ideas from this encounter with the Caribbean. And at the same time, the pages of Tropique are rife with inspiration from the surrealists. And to my way of thinking, at least, the Césaires, both Aimé and Suzanne, utilize surrealist ideas as part of their struggle against Vichy. Now, there's a lot of layers to this story, one of which is it wasn't easy to say what one wanted to say in Vichy-controlled Martinique. And the pages of Tropique are also a cat and mouse game where you have these explosive new ideas, influenced by the far left in part, getting past the censors. And they're getting past the censors, interestingly, because of points of commonality that both sides are playing on. So Vichy censors are encouraging a return to the past, a return to tradition. And in some of the pages of Tropique, one sees a point of ostentatious conversion here between that and what they're trying to do, which is a rediscovery of Martinique's past and a rediscovery of African origins. And it's on that very tenuous point of intersection that the pages of Tropique continue to be published under Vichy. And none of that would have been possible, at least in the configuration that it took, without these chance encounters between refugees on the one hand and Martinique intellectuals on the other. So really you have this incredible profusion of ideas around a little circle of intellectuals based really in this quite remarkable establishment, the Lycée Scholcher in Fort-de-France. And these ideas really conjure up a revolution that's fundamentally going to change everything from colonialism to tiers-mondisme in the subsequent 30 years.
That's so fascinating. And then, as you mentioned, in 1941, the corridor closes. So what happened?
So it closes quite abruptly, almost as quickly as it is set up. And there's no single explanation. There are monumental tensions building around this corridor. Part of it has to do with U.S. anxieties. And those U.S. anxieties are many. On the one hand, you have people in Washington quite concerned about a possible fifth column. These boats are full of people with German-sounding last names. And the State Department is constantly asking the U.S. consular officials in Fort-de-France to investigate rumors that there might be Gestapo agents on board these boats, or fifth columnists, as I said. In other words, that these refugees might actually contain some wolves posing as sheep in their midst. That's one concern. Another set of concerns revolve around the very presence of this sort of Vichy needle in the Western Hemisphere and its flouting of the Monroe Doctrine. So the very fact that these islands are still loyal to Vichy, of course, is a cause for concern. Now, prior to U.S. involvement in the war, all of this is relatively low grade. But nevertheless, if you read the pages of the Washington Post, the New York Times in this era, you'll see a great many articles floating the idea that German U-boats are somehow, you know, refueling in Martinique or Guyane or Guadeloupe, all of which turn out to be false. I mean, the one story that does have basis is that a German sub with a wounded officer surfaces on a beach in Martinique, ditches the wounded officer, and then leaves again. That's about the extent
hardly
of it.
Refueling.
Right. You can see how these things in wartime with the Bobard, the famous false rumors, would gain in amplitude. And this idea that somehow the French Caribbean was a kind of Axis beachhead was one that really worried people in the Western Hemisphere. So there's those sets of concerns. There's another set of concerns, which is those articulated in London, right? So the British have long wanted all French colonies to go over to General de Gaulle's Free French. And already in 1940, they were quite explicitly saying that that would be achieved by starving the territories in question through a naval blockade. Interestingly, in Martinique and Guadeloupe, the vast majority of the population wanted to go over to General de Gaulle. It was the naval clique in power, loyal to Vichy, that prevented it. So the British goal here was to try to limit the amount of shipping reaching Martinique, because Martinique and Guadeloupe still relied on foreign wheat, for instance, or on cod for the famous cod fritters that people in the French Caribbean so enjoy to this day. So it was the idea from London was to try to strangle off the islands and orchestrate a coup or a regime change in favor of General de Gaulle. Last but not least, the Germans are also concerned about these islands, right? They're concerned that the aircraft carrier that's posted there might fall into U.S. hands. In other words, there's tectonic concerns over the French Caribbean. Ultimately, the final nail in the coffin takes place in April, May 1940, when a Dutch naval ship intercepts two freighters on the high seas, bound for Martinique, filled with refugees, on the assumption that they are either carrying contraband or Gestapo agents, or both in all likelihood. These ships are then intercepted. Vichy demands to have the ships back. The ships end up in Trinidad. All of the refugees on board, in fact, the sailors too, everybody is subjected to quite intense interviewing. At the end of the day, the French nationals on board are offered to join the fighting French. As far as I can tell, very few, if any, accept. And the refugees are then sent on their way. Although a handful remain in Trinidad, those refugees are sent on their way, and many end up again in Mexico or South America, Argentina, and mostly the United States. But after that, Vichy demands guarantees on ships that could sail. Those guarantees take a long time in coming. And finally, when the route does reopen several months later, it is explicitly without refugees on board, and the U.S. demands to be able to see the passenger manifests and inspect them. Wow. So it's a series of anxieties, probably the most intense of which has to do with U.S. concerns that these refugees are, in fact, fifth columnists, and these recurring anxieties over that.
Fascinating. And that complicates even more this question between escape or rescue, but we'll come back to that.
It certainly does.
And so what then happens to the refugees themselves after the corridor unravels? I mean, are the camps still set up? Where do they ultimately end up?
So the two camps that I mentioned, Balata and Le Lazaret in Martinique, are really designed to handle no more than 400 refugees at once. And the onus is on refugees to use Martinique only as a temporary location. And from what I can tell, the vast majority of these refugees spend fewer than 3 months in Martinique. Now, it doesn't mean that it doesn't impact them. On the contrary, I have, you know, Czech painters and German novelists all reflecting Martinique in their art in some way or another, even though they spent only a few weeks there in some instances. But the idea is that they will move on to greener pastures and mostly safer pastures, which many of them manage to do. Some of them have their visas expire while in Martinique because it takes so long to get to the U.S. Others end up going to Canada. Others still, as I say, to South America. Some end up going to the Dominican Republic and Haiti. There's a broad number of scenarios as to where they ultimately end up. A handful of them actually just can't get out. They are caught in a kind of limbo as so some of them are literally stateless because they've been denaturalized by Nazi Germany and they don't have French nationality. And some of these people are just left in limbo in the French Caribbean. One of them dies in the French Caribbean later on. A handful of them are actually threatened with being sent back to either Morocco or France. And the U.S. consul on location actually gets on the line with the State Department saying, listen, the French authorities here are saying there can't be much of a threat against them or else we would allow them into the U.S. So this is a sort of horrible catch-22 that these refugees find themselves in, where they are not seen as being in mortal danger by the Americans and therefore might be sent back by the Vichy French. There's actually one instance that I find of somebody being sent back only to have that boat then intercepted by the British on the high seas. So some quite extraordinary and harrowing tales of last minute escape from Vichy, but also potential if not deportation, redeployment back to Europe.
Now, before we sort of close, I want to bring us back to the question that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview and that I sort of just jumped back to. I mean, the book is called Escape from Vichy, but of course, as you've mentioned, this is a problem that you're grappling with. Is this rescue? Is this escape? Is it a little bit of both? Now that we've sort of talked about the entire book, what answer do you settle on?
Well, it's not an easy one. And certainly even the term escape is loaded, right? What I'm looking at is boats full of European Jews, European dissidents, European socialists and communists all wanting to leave the old continent for the safety of the new one. Interestingly, the refugees themselves conjure up all sorts of metaphors, right? Some of them talk about, they have references to the pilgrims, to persecuted religious minorities. Others explicitly reference slavery. There's all sorts of different metaphors that they use themselves.
Well, and you mentioned Exodus too in your title.
Exodus, absolutely. All of these are bandied about as references. The other problem with the very term escape, and I know it's in my title, is that we're projecting backwards slightly. I mean, I go into great detail over the kinds of threats that refugees face in mainland France. If the Kunt Commission, for instance, which is in charge of enforcing that article of the armistice about sending Germans and Austrians back to Germany, that could very easily have befallen, that fate could have befallen many German nationals or former German nationals in southern France. So for them, yes, it's escape. For others, it's anticipating the threat. And as I talk about in the book, there's refugees who die of heart attacks in Varian Fry's office. So worried are they? And they're rightly worried. They're worried because they've drawn caricatures of Adolf Hitler or because they've been outspoken critics of Nazism. And suddenly they find themselves in southern France in this kind of no man's land, where although the region is not occupied, there is this looming sense of danger. And of course, by 1942, these fears would prove to be validated because Vichy would start handing over some of these refugees, these Jewish refugees, even before the Nazis invaded the so-called unoccupied zone in November of 1942. So part of this is also about situating it in context, making sure I'm not jumping forward, but also retrieving the anxieties of the era. As for the question of whether it's expulsion or rescue, I think that Marcel Perrouton's letter that I invoked from November 1940 is really at the crux of this question. So to me, Vichy wanted to be rid of these people. And this speaks to multiple impulses, right? In the 1930s, the French Republic was faced with this huge refugee crisis at a time of considerable economic strain. And in fairness to France, most nations of the Western Hemisphere just weren't taking people in, right? Estimates suggest that France took in maybe 200,000 Jewish people between 1900 and 1940 from other theaters. So they found themselves in France with nowhere else to go. And certainly France's doors were more wide open than those of the Western Hemisphere through the 1930s. So I think we can speak of successive different reactions and impulses. One of them, the Third Republic's, was these makeshift camps. Admittedly, people faced a lot of discrimination in their everyday life. And admittedly, the xenophobic part of French society was making itself heard in the 30s. But it was still possible to live in France in the 30s. By the time France falls in May, June 1940, the circumstances really change. As I said, these refugees are now being pinpointed not so much as parasites as being identified supposedly as the cause for France's defeat, the enemy within, according to some particularly violent and vicious Vichy voices. And all of a sudden as well, from the standpoint of Germany, if these are former German nationals or former Austrian nationals, Germany can ask for them to be handed over. So there's considerable risk now for these people. And Vichy's impulse then is, listen, they're overrepresented. We don't want them. They're a burden on the French nation. Let's be rid of them. And I think it's significant that the first way of getting rid of them, at least in this Perrouton memo, is, well, let's try to send them to the Western Hemisphere. But Perrouton himself in this document says, well, we're not having much luck in our negotiations with the US, with Cuba, with Mexico, et cetera. So barring that, as a last sort of resort, we'll send them to the French colonies, which, although we're getting backlash from them, we can sort of impose this. And it's a kind of intermediate solution. And it is, in a sense, a rescripting of earlier schemes, right? You think of, for instance, the fantasy of sending Jewish people to Madagascar, which goes way back to the 19th century, or indeed to French Guiana, French Guinea. These sorts of ideas had been written, rewritten, scripted, rescripted, incidentally, by, you know, Jewish organizations, but also by anti-Semitic groups ever since the late 19th century. The idea of creating a new Jewish homeland somewhere else had been floated for some time. So it's a kind of rescripting of these ideas. But as I said, it also speaks to an early Vichy impulse to be rid of the refugees one way or another. This, I think, then helps to explain the ways in which these refugees are thrown into these camps. But it's also important to keep in mind that in 1940 and 41, it was still possible to get out of Les Mille. And some of the more touching correspondence that I see is from refugees trying to cobble together the necessary sponsors in the United States and failing, or proving to the American authorities that they're not going to become somehow a liability or a burden if they get to the States. So it's those incredible challenges that they faced. To my amazement, other scholars have written about it, a place like Les Mille had a refugee officer until 1941 who was responsible for trying to get people out to other continents. And that refugee officer definitely directed some of the refugees I've looked at towards Martinique, saying it was the best option in late 1940 and early 1941. So that speaks to a certain amount of coordination, and it speaks to a way in which Vichy was committed to sending refugees, again, either abroad or to French colonies. This is, again, something that somebody like Vicky Caron has written about extensively. And that prefigures a far more radical attitude at Vichy. It has to do also with the return of Pierre Laval. It has to do with German demands, but which will be adopted later in 1942, which involves serious complicity and in deportations and turning a place like Les Mille from what it had been, which was a refugee internment center, into an antechamber to the Hansi, which itself was the last stop before Auschwitz. All of that is going to change very dramatically over the course of 1942. And so I look in my book at these close calls, these near misses, but also an amazing character like Jean Malaquais. So Jean Malaquais, French language novelist of Jewish Polish extraction, who tries to get onto the boats to Martinique and fails, writes with envy of, you know, Victor Serge and André Breton and others getting out while he can't, and finally manages to find his way out in 1942, just a mere few months before the Germans invade the southern zone. So I'm also interested in this question of who made the boat and why. And at the end of the day, it certainly helps to have had influential contacts in the Americas. It helps to have had somebody like Varian Fry going to bat for you. That's certainly true. But there's also a great deal of luck. So somebody, Assayas, who I talk about as a filmmaker in here, also known by the name of Jacques Rémy, a pseudonym that he gave himself in the 30s. Jacques Rémy talks about how, you know, essentially, he owed the fact that he made the boat to débrouillardise, which is to say a certain amount of getting by, and also sheer luck. And of course, last but not least, the complicity of people along the way. So the complicity of low-ranking administrators who helped, some of them turning a blind eye, others actively suggesting, you know, you should go in line at the shipping company because the Martinique line is your best bet. And interestingly, intentions here become blurred, right? So Anna Segers talks about some people helping her out, but also some Vichy policemen yelling at her, saying that she is a burden on society and needs to leave for other shores as quickly as possible. In this instance, you have actually an anti-Semite urging her to leave. And intentions, as I said, can become somewhat messy. He too is intent on seeing her go, no less than Perrouton. But for a different kind of reason.
Right. Oh, it's such a complex history. It's such a fascinating book. Congratulations on this.
Oh, I really appreciate
this accomplishment.
It. Thank you.
And thank you for talking to us about it. Before I let you go, though, I want to know, I know this has just come out, but what are you working on next?
Well, as I suggested, we always have things on the back burner. So before this book, my previous one had been on Free French Africa and World War II. And I've worked on a series of World War II topics tied to French colonies. And I want to leave the Second World War a little bit for my next project. So I'm contemplating doing a global history of vanilla, which is a very different kind of topic. But it would be a commodity chain history looking at the ways in which this edible orchid went from being a staple of Central America to a French colonial staple by the 19th century. And I'm particularly interested in ways in which forms of indigenous or slave knowledge played into the cultivation of vanilla, and the ways in which vanilla became a source of livelihood for populations all over the French Empire, from French South Pacific, places like Tahiti, to the world's biggest producer, which is Madagascar. So this will bring me back to Madagascar, back to the French colonial archives. And although it's worlds removed from Escape from Vichy, it does also have to do with circulations, in a sense.
And I guess back to Aix-en-Provence, which is not a bad place to do research.
Yes, I won't lie to you. Having spent at least 4 years of my life now in the archives at Aix, I consider Aix to be a home away from home, and indeed a really lovely place to do research. And I would add wonderful archivists who perhaps have a little bit more time for researchers than the ones in the National Archives in Paris. It's tied to the National Archives in Paris, but a much smaller population of researchers actually visits the Aix-en-Provence archives outside of maybe July and August. And so it really is easier to get individualized attention and to thrive.
Well, that sounds like such a fascinating project. I look forward to reading the next book.
Well, thanks so much for your kind words. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Oh, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. This was fantastic.
All right. Thanks again. Take care.
Bye now. That was Eric Jennings of the University of Toronto talking to us about his new book, Escape from Vichy, The Refugee Exodus to the French Caribbean, which is available now through Harvard University Press. If you like listening to New Books in Jewish Studies, please consider subscribing to us and toss us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We really appreciate hearing from you guys. Thanks for tuning in.